On last week and perhaps the week before, we started touching on the topic of how we create reality, how we manifest our destination, so to speak. And at the same time, on HarryMedia.net forums, there have been discussions about a similar topic, which I found to be very interesting personally. And it has led me to want to discuss this further. It has led me to want to explore how our will, how our desire, how our energy helps to manifest all that comes to us. Now, I don't want to make the mistake of trying to declare that we are completely, uniquely responsible for all that manifests in our lives. And neither do I want to, and actually I would like to correct any misunderstanding that may have appeared, that may have seemed to be me minimizing the very wonderful situation in Goloka Vrindavan, for example. What I was trying to do by our discussion, what I have been trying to do by what I am writing, is to make it clear which mechanisms are operating that allow us to enter into such facilities as Goloka Vrindavan, for example. Now, don't get me wrong when I say mechanism. I'm not speaking about a machine. I'm not speaking about something mechanistic. I am talking about that that operational energy, that function of our energy, which operates to allow our energy to create and allows us to enter into that creation. Now, when I said before that I don't wish to minimize the beauty and wonder of Goloka Vrindavan, I said that because when I was describing this mechanism, I might have given the impression that the only reason people end up in such a situation is because they have been taught to do so through some discipline, and that actually they're just going into some group kind of a creation which may have some illusion about it. That's not at all true. But I realized after we discussed these things that that impression could have been there because of the analytical way I was describing how one enters into such manifestations, such existences. So to help amplify this, I want to go back a few steps and start over again, but this time explain the relevance and the justification for any ultimate existence one wishes to be part of. And at the end, I wish to explain how my personal preference is Goloka Vrindavan, for instance, because of the beautiful relationship between Radha and Krishna and everyone else. So let's define a few terms which are very important, which are actually paramount in our understanding of what we're talking about. Now, when I said ultimate existence, I did not use the word reality. And when I said ultimate, I was hesitant. And that is part of these definitions I wish to speak about. To explain my hesitancy in using the word ultimate, I'd like to start off by a little discussion about the word reality. Now, I know that I have also been guilty of kicking aside, smashing, disrespecting, these standard forms or definitions which have been accepted for centuries throughout the whole world. I'm not doing it because I wish that everybody would cease to consider them important. Rather, what I'm trying to do is get to the concepts upon which these definitions or these words rest, so that we can understand the broader picture, which is very good for our spiritual consciousness and awareness. Now, traditionally, there have been discussions about reality and illusion. There are these two concepts that seem to be quite opposite of each other. Now, the reason these two concepts are so essential in traditional discussions of philosophy or spirituality is to differentiate our present state of consciousness from that desired state of consciousness in which we are connected to the spiritual reality or energy. But by trying to get that facility to make it easier to approach the spiritual reality, the very creation of these definitions makes it harder in the long run to approach that reality. There are short-term requirements which help us move forward, but over the long term, these requirements may no longer be relevant. For example, speaking about the present existence as illusion and the ultimate existence as reality, although it is very good to help differentiate between spiritual and material, in the long run, it doesn't really help us connect to the spiritual. It's good to start us. It's good to get us going. It may be good for lifetimes of endeavors in a spiritual path. But to make that final link between something within this realm and that realm, we have to embrace the concept that reality is right now. Illusion factually does not exist. That's the nature of it. It is something which is not real, not real, not existing. However, when we understand that it doesn't exist, we then accept what is here is reality. The problem is that when we are not developed, when we are not aware of what we're talking about here, what the real situation is, we will misunderstand reality. And misunderstanding reality does not allow us to enter into the spiritual realm properly. Now, in order to deal with the ultimate steps, the last steps required to go from the present state to the totally aware, evolved, and connected state, one must come to the understanding that what is there with me, within me, around me, connected to me, this is my reality that I have to deal with. Now, this idea is a subtle idea. It's an idea based similarly as one would speak about a very advanced soul who is existing within this realm, but whose consciousness is fully connected with the expanded reality, the expanded realm. Now, to clarify this point, the idea of illusion is a misunderstanding of what is around us. What is around us is not illusion. It's my perception of its relationship with me and my relationship with it that is not complete. My integration with the existence around me and my reciprocation with it is not in full awareness of the bigger picture. So making all of this illusion and therefore trying to negate it to get to some other realm is actually the wrong method. The proper understanding is that I should understand what it really is. I should really integrate with all that is around me and reciprocate with it in the spiritual way, from the platform of the spiritual energy. And then, when I can do that, I am already within the spiritual realm while I am here. That is an essential point, because dying does not change that much in your consciousness. That's why it is stated that your consciousness at the time of death leads you into the next existence, the next birth or whatever. The process of death in and of itself does not add to your spiritual consciousness. It simply moves your awareness from one physical environment to some other environment. Not physical, it's another environment. So our same exact awareness that we have now is there right after death and onwards. So the idea of death being the gateway to liberation is based in a misunderstanding. The liberation takes place within our conscious awareness on this kind of a platform. So if we were to, for a second, be at the end of our lives, about to transfer ourselves to the spiritual reality, we would, by definition, have to already be there to get there. Because if you weren't already there, you couldn't get there. Now, of course, people will throw in concepts such as mercy, where simply by some mercy from some authority, some force somewhere, you will be pulled from here to there. But that is, if it exists, a rare case. Because after all, if that mercy were to exist, it would mean that authority is now overriding your consciousness with the touch of the mercy to transform your consciousness into something else so that you will then transfer from here to there. And then you run into the problem of why is that mercy being given to you? Why not to someone else? What is the criterion for getting the mercy and so on? I want to avoid all that right now because it's a rare situation. So, look, when we're speaking here, we're speaking about just common sense reality that if you're going to transfer yourself from this plane to some ultimate plane, again, we have the problem of this word ultimate, you've got to already be there to get there. Just think about that. So that means that the discipline, if we can use the word, that one must accept has to integrate the spiritual consciousness within this realm. Otherwise, you will have a great possibility of not getting there. The solution is to integrate the consciousness, integrate the understanding, the awareness within all of the energies that are operating right now and to use each and every energy in that context. That's why being of service is so important, to use one's spiritual energy in the service of other spiritual energies, other personalities, to assist them, help them in any way in their path, to be of service in such a way to expand the love that is there coming from Radha and Krishna. To not reject this world out of fear or disgust, for that will not assist in the integration, but rather to accept it as it is and deal with it for what it is. Now, all right, we've made this point. We've got to get there now before we can get there, wherever it is. I was trying to explain this in terms of reality as versus to illusion. I suppose in one sense I have given a definition of illusion. But it is not illusion. It is simply an incomplete understanding. There's a difference. And that's what I'm trying to bring out here. It's not illusory. It's incomplete. There's a big difference between these two things. Let's take the example of a magician. Somebody who's pulling rabbits out of the hat. Now, the illusion is something that person wished to give you the idea that he's actually pulling a rabbit that wasn't there out of the hat. Now, that is not an illusion like, for example, it doesn't exist. It's just a misunderstanding, or rather an incomplete understanding of what's really going on. The real understanding is that, you know, under the table there's a hole and he pulls the rabbit up through the table, hole in the table, or there's false bottoms to hats, or all kinds of things, whatever it may be that magicians do. He has managed to make you think he's pulled out the rabbit, but in reality he just took the rabbit from one place and took it to another place. Now, the incomplete understanding of the magic trick, is that an essential understanding? I mean, is it important? Is it really important that one understands fully how the magic trick works? A complete understanding would be to know in truth how the magic trick works. Yet, it would completely ruin the effect of what the magician is trying to give to you. The magician is trying to give you a show, trying to give you pleasure, trying to give you some fun in life, some excitement in life. Now, if I were to say that's incomplete and that's not the full understanding, you should understand the real mechanism by which that rabbit came out of the hat, I would be performing you a disservice. And this is the key to what I've been trying to get across. Yes, the magician is doing an illusion. And yes, there is a knowledge and awareness behind the illusion. But no, it is not necessarily good to know that. Because the fun of it would be gone. Do you understand? The point of it would be gone. The whole reason for the magician to learn his art, the whole reason for the magician to perform like this would be lost. You can transfer this understanding to many aspects of life. Now, I'm going to do it for a little bit. A little baby, human baby, a little animal baby, a little puppy, a little kitten, a little baby rabbit, anything little baby is cute, adorable, wonderful. You want to hug them. You want to hold them. If you were to elevate yourself beyond this situation and look at it from some detached state, you might say, this is illusion because it's just some biomechanism to support the species. The love between mother and child and parents and between man and woman, the way in which we are excited by these various forms of sensuality in our lives, all of these things are simply rooted in biomechanisms for the preservation of the species, for a mechanistic way in which the world can go on. The food you eat, the way in which the tastes and flavors are made, or the sounds you may hear, these are all part of a grand illusion that are totally divorced from actual reality. They're just the way these things play on your physical senses. So when you do like this, what you do is you strip away any feeling you may have for anything in this world. You strip away the very connection between your energy and anything else. Let's take that to the ultimate state. You are just about to die, and you have stripped away all connection to anything in this world. You are now in a totally detached state. And then you die. So what happens? Nothing. You are in the same state. In this way, voidism has reality to it because of the creation of the people who feel it is advantageous to have such a state of consciousness. So in the Vaishnava tradition, they deal similarly with detachment, but they're very aware that without attachment, you get nowhere. So they try to do both at the same time. So skipping all possible imperfections in the process, let's get right to the very end and let's discuss what happens. Let's just take a few examples. For example, food again. That illusory taste, that illusory combination of chemicals transforms into a spiritual act when it is connected with the Supreme. You are chewing, you are tasting. The tastes are now inspiring you spiritually. Why? Because you are seeing it in connection with the divine energy. The same with sounds, beautiful music connected to the divine. It transports you there because you've integrated that present experience together with the divine experience. And those who are fully integrated in this way are in that exact state I was speaking about before. Their sensual energy of their spirit, their essence, is integrated within this realm right now to fully with the spiritual energy. And for all intents and purposes, there is no need to go anywhere because they're already there. And when being there at the time of death, they're still there. That is the justification for all of this spiritual understanding of transformation of this consciousness to spiritual consciousness. What I have been speaking about week after week, month after month, and year after year is a similar thing. I have been saying the exact same thing, that we can right now, right here, integrate our energy totally with the spiritual energy as we wish under our control. It's not something we have to first detach ourselves from to attain. In other words, by learning the process of integration, you assemble the spiritual energy around you in the way in which your energy yearns for. Now, it is very interesting. I have to admit, one pandit in India said that what I have been speaking is purely the philosophy of Ramanuja. I am very personally unhappy with having to deal with these differences. All these differences, all of these ways in which we separate ourselves from others, all of these ways in which we end up saying, I am better, you are worse. I know it's not the right thing, but we do it. I don't like it. Constantly referring to and defining ourselves opposite to the reality around us. With this idea, by detaching ourselves fully from all of that, which is no good, we will easily be able to attach ourselves to that, which is good. I don't see it working. I love the energy. I loved reading about Ramanuja. Just anything he said, anything he did, I thought, this person is fabulous. To always embrace the similarity, embrace that oneness which is there between us. The oneness with the Supreme. Within this understanding of our being individuated within that oneness. That state where the interests of the lover and the beloved become one. The complete integration of energies. So when one sees like this, life is less of a fight. Now, some people like to fight. Some people find defining themselves by fighting is a very valuable inspiration for them. But the problem is they don't know when to stop fighting. They don't know when to say enough is enough. They don't know when to say, why am I so concerned about what somebody else might think, what somebody else might say, what somebody else might do? Why do I have to be so concerned with every little thing around me in some manner by which it will seemingly define me in a way I don't like? Let's stop right here and start to discuss this concept of ultimate, which I had problem with in the beginning. Not that I have problem with it, but it made me uncomfortable to use the word. I hate, not hate, but it makes me very uncomfortable to use words like this is the absolute, this is the relative, this is the objective, this is the subjective, this is the ultimate, and this is something temporary and eternal, and all of these terms which disintegrate us from the reality that we have. Ultimate, it gives you this feeling of finality. Finally, you've made it, you're there, you can rest. Your endeavor is over, your work is over, you have arrived. It's like, you know, these movies where, you know, there are these struggles in the movies, and at the end, there's a happy ending and everyone lives happily ever after. We project that in our feelings. We have struggled so much here in this world that there will be a happy ending and we will live happily ever after. In that ultimate state, in that ultimate situation. Now, everybody wants to live happily ever after. That's the nature of all people. But everybody has different experiences. Everybody's consciousness is built in a different way. And different people build their way to the happily ever after according to what they feel is right for them. Now, let's get one thing straight. Somebody may say, are you saying all destinations are equal? All destinations are the same. One is as good as the other. Well, not yes and no. Yes, generically, it is so. No, for me, not so. I wouldn't be happy ending up in that void state or in some Christian heaven or in some Islamic heaven or in any other position. I'd be happy with Radha and Krishna, me personally. But somebody else may and will create their quote-unquote ultimate reality, ultimate existence, the ultimate happy ending, according to their energetic inclination. Does that mean that some people may end up with God, with the Supreme, with the ultimate absolute truth, and some may not? Let's look at it from a Vaishnava perspective. There is only Radha and Krishna, and that is the ultimate end, and anything else is something else entirely. But wait a minute. There are, for example, Lakshmi Narayan planets. There's hundreds and thousands and unlimited of them. There's the place of Lord Ramachandra. There's other places of different avatars. There seems to be unlimited amounts of destinations. Are they all defined? Are they all described? Are they limited? Is it really stated by the Supreme? Only someone who believes in Hindu literature, I know the word Hindu, blah, 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 in Hindu literature can attain one of these hundreds of millions of spiritual planets and no one else. Or is it whoever has integrated themselves with the spiritual essence, the spiritual energy, at that time when they depart from this vehicle, will they enter into that realm according to their inclination? Yes, the happy ending for some is that situation where there is nothing. The happy ending for others is that situation with a specific kind of a God. That happy ending for others is a situation of Lakshmi Narayan or Radha and Krishna. There are definitely happy endings for everybody. So ultimate simply means that happy ending for you in connection with your deity, your loved one, your beloved, the one you wish to render service to, because it is that rendering of service, being of service, which is the mechanism which brings you to that place. And when you have integrated your energy, when you have integrated it, it is that with whom you have integrated that you enter into the association of when this vehicle is dropped. And there is complete freedom to integrate your energy with any other energy anywhere at any time. And according to how you integrate, I'm not talking about just some connection. You worship a demigod, you go to the demigod kind of a thing. I'm not speaking about that. I'm talking about integrating my essence with other essences. It's different. My essence integrating within that matrix of all essence, that real spiritual union we're talking about here. And that can be from any platform, and you can create that reality according to your particular inclination. So, Radha and Krishna are there. They exist. Whether or not you think so doesn't bother me. My energy, my essence integrates with their energy, their essence. I feel it. I like it. I cultivate it. I nourish it. If somebody else wishes to integrate their energy with an old man with a beard as the supreme, the divine, I'm sure Radha and Krishna can manifest their energy in that way and allow that integration to take place with pleasure. The particular format of the integration is not the essential point. The essential point is the loving energy, the exchange of loving energy. That is the integration. That is the reality. That is the ultimate connection. Me personally, I find it very uninspiring to try to integrate my energy, my essence, with an old man with a beard. It just doesn't inspire me. I don't mind if other people do it. It doesn't threaten me. It doesn't threaten me. It doesn't disturb me when other people say, this is the ultimate absolute. It doesn't disturb me. It doesn't upset me when Hare Krishnas run around the world saying, this is only the absolute and all the rest of you are in Maya. Because none of this has anything to do with my personal integration of my energy of love with Radha and Krishna. And in that integration of love, I am equally comfortable and would be willing and desirous of rendering service if desired, if required, if it's useful, if I can be of service to any person with any philosophy, with any understanding. In this song of the Goswamis, it's Dira Dira Jana Priya Priya Karo Nirmatsaro Pujito. Think about that. They were equally loved by, they equally cared for complete nonsenses and those who were greatly spiritual. In other words, they didn't discriminate. You are good, you are bad. I'll take care of you, I won't take care of you. I'll render service to you, but not you. Everyone loved them. Why? Because they were present, they were there, they were integrating with all people. Now a neophyte may say, well, that's because they presented Radha and Krishna in such a way that even demoniac persons or any envious kind of person could understand it and therefore they were thankful. That is a silly idea. It doesn't matter who you are. You can be the most advanced person. You go up to somebody like that and you throw at them this foreign concept, and you even do it in a very loving way. They'll just walk away and think you're crazy, or they may even do worse. What it really means, and historically this is proven, that they cared about everybody. They shared what they could with anybody for the benefit of others. Historically, Sanatana Goswami would travel from village to village, and he would speak to the villagers. He would ask, how are you? How is your wife? How is your daughter? How are things going? He would care about people. He never thought, oh, God, you're in Maya. My God, you're having sex at night. I can't talk to you. And he also didn't do it as a preaching tactic. It wasn't that he thought, as some people might think, I'll be friendly and ask and about how you're doing and seemingly care, but all I really care about is giving you this message because you need it. People are not stupid. As soon as you do like that, as soon as you even start doing like that, they go, what, are you kidding me? But when you're really connected, when you are really integrated, your essence is really integrated with Radha and Krishna, you will understand the unity. You will understand the connection these people have within that matrix of Radha and Krishna. You will understand the inability of anything to be disconnected. And with that state of consciousness, you cannot discriminate between that this is a bad creation, this stone, this stool, this mud, this dirt is to be rejected, and cleanliness and all that is to be accepted. You have integrated it all. It doesn't mean you make no distinction, but you've integrated it. It doesn't mean you take the poop and you bring it in the kitchen because it's all the same. But it means you do accept all things within the context of what they are, without having to start negating, rejecting, fearing, hating, disgusting. Okay, I don't want to get into again this. I get very riled up by this because it's an emotional point for me because of my history, okay? But I don't want to go further with this point. I accept my history. It's been very good for me. It's been very good to me. I don't mean to be upset about it. It's not the point. But I care. You see, I care. And in that caring, I'm trying to present an alternative. That alternative being the integration of our spiritual energy, the integration of our love within the world around us. I propose that when we act with that integration, when we act with that connection, our actions are so much more powerful than when we act with an ulterior motive. Even if it's a good ulterior motive, even if it's good, even if you think it's a good ulterior motive, that when you preach to somebody, quote unquote, when you awaken somebody from Maya, quote unquote, that's a good thing. All right, even if it's that, it's still an ulterior motive because everything you do with others is for some motive. Therefore, you cannot connect with anybody. Therefore, you must always keep a distance. You must fear because you could become swallowed by illusion. But when you see it in another way, you will care and you will not judge people for what they are. And you will be happy that they, by your help, can take step forward towards getting relief, getting towards their desire for the happy ending. Me personally, I don't see a difference between a person taking one step from back there forward or a person taking one step from up there forward. For me, I see the step. That's what gives me pleasure. I like to be of service for all persons to make that step. That's how I integrate my essence with the essence of Radha and Krishna, because Radha and Krishna don't look where you are and then judge you. I like to integrate my essence. I like to integrate my vision with the vision of the divine. Otherwise, I just don't feel happy. Can I do that all the time? Nah. Sometimes it's like, what's the use of my life? Sometimes I think, God, I'm just wasting time. I wish I could do more. I wish I could do something. And other times I think, yes, this is it. This is great. I love it. I think I'm quite extreme. But that's just the way I am. So I, with my energy, with my ups and downs, with my way of seeing things, my way of connection, I do what I can. Do I walk around all day in complete ecstasy and bliss, feeling happy about that? No. But when I'm in that situation, when I can do something, boy, do I feel good about it. I remember I had once Amel long ago. I haven't spoken with Amel in, I don't know, 6 years or something. But he said something interesting to me. He said, a tool is no less a tool when it's not being used. Can you imagine you've got a carpenter and he's got his hammers and he's got his chisels and he's got his screwdrivers and he's got his nails. And if the screwdriver was screaming, use me, use me. And the hammer was screaming, no, use me. So the carpenter says, wait a minute, guys, I can't use all the tools at the same time. I'll use the chisel now and I'll use the hammer. Okay, screwdriver, you sit there and be peaceful. I'll get to you. And wrench, I'll get to you. Just wait, wait, just be patient. Now, I have an interesting joke to tell you in regards to this, which I always loved. There was two carpenters, and there was a box of nails. So, the one carpenter was throwing out half the nails. So the other carpenter asked him, why are you throwing out half the nails? And he said, because they had the head on the wrong end. You know, nail has a head and a spike so you can bang it in. So he said, half the nails had the head on the wrong end. And the other carpenter just looked at him and shook his head. He said, you complete idiot! Those nails were for the other side of the house! Here's a good question. I like this question because it's related to what I was saying, and it also helps to clear up ambiguity in what I was saying. So in this question, it says basically like this. When you work for the sake of others, often people tend to abuse this or exploit us. And another possibility is that when we try to, or when we get ourselves entangled in solving other people's problems, they tend to give us more and more problems and they become weaker because they cannot solve their own problems. Because in that sense, they would become a burden, which would be not at all good. And another part of this question is we might see some ulterior motives in other people. And even if they have some, shall we say, inferior motivation, should we help them with that particular motivation? Now, this is a good question, but actually, I didn't mean it in the way in which it is being stated. Let me discuss a little bit more what it means to help a person make a step, because I think that's very important. When you're going to help somebody make a step, that does not mean that you have to help them fulfill their present desires. It does not mean that whatever their particular whim or fancy is at the present moment, or whatever problem they're having at the present moment, you've got to solve that or give them that. For example, if an alcoholic needs a drink. I did not mean that to be of service means you should give them a drink. This is another thing completely. This is not at all what I'm talking about. What I said was, you help them take a step forward. Taking a step forward means to take a step forward in their progressive evolution. This does not mean solving problems. This does not mean satisfying desires. But what it does mean is that wherever they are situated, doesn't matter how far back, how far forward, how far to the side, that when it's appropriate to do so, assisting them to make one step forward is a very satisfying thing. That might even be done by listening to somebody, just hearing what they say and sympathetically offering them support. That might be done by just giving somebody a hug when they feel helpless and hopeless. It might be done even by giving a gift to a homeless person or some money to somebody who's hungry just when they need it. It might be just a moment of shared love. It might be saying something which is exactly relevant to their situation so that they gain in their understanding. There are many different ways in which we can be of service, in which we can assist somebody to come closer in contact with themselves, to make that next step. And none of them have to be connected with solving their problems or fulfilling their desires, but are rather related to simply being there with our full awareness, our full love, to offer something of value to a person who needs it or wants it so that they can move forward. I don't think there's any rules how to do it. I don't think there's any formulas how to do it. I don't think there's any particular right and wrong in it, but rather when you feel you can actually render that service and that person accepts it in that way, it is a powerful experience for both. And naturally, helping people find out the way that they can solve their own problems is a wonderful service. Sometimes people don't know how to do that. Sometimes they're not even at the point where they can even learn a technique to do it. Sometimes I don't mind helping solve somebody's problem if I can easily do it. But if somebody were to again approach me to continue that relationship, I would naturally turn the relationship to one where my assistance to them would be to assist them to learn how to solve problems. For example, if somebody didn't know or didn't have faith that I could even help them, and if I could help them, when I did help them solve a problem, then they might find it advantageous to consult with me again. So at that time, I would assist them to understand the process by which they can solve problems. Again, I am rendering service. I am not a servant. They do not direct what I do. I direct what I do. In this way, we avoid the problem of people draining us, because we are in charge of how we offer service. And in that way, we can consider in every situation, regardless of whatever it is they think or feel or want, whether or not it is advantageous for us and them that I offer service to them. And I think that would resolve the particular problem of this question. How am I glad this question is asked, because I was going to speak about something totally different in this discussion, and I ended up talking about, again, a different subject. And so this brings it back to what I wanted. Now, this question is a very, very good question. It says that, like, for example, in The Magician and the illusion of the rabbit out of the hat, sometimes we might feel that understanding behind the illusion of trouble or the reality of our situation might be a very good thing to do. And because if we do it, we would be able to avoid trouble. We would be able to avoid conflict. We would be able to change negativity into positivity. And so he gives the example here of the before the battlefield of Kurukshetra, some yogi somewhere was meditating and could burn up all the negativity and make the Kauravas and the Pandavas friends, all the bloodshed would have been avoided, and there wouldn't have had to be a problem with the politics, and everything could have been fine. Then again, how would that relate in our own lives? In other words, if we manipulate circumstances, if we manipulate things to burn away the negativity, we can bring order in our life, we can bring peace in our life, and somehow stop trying to avoid having to deal with problems. Great question, and this was one of the subjects of something I wrote in the HarryMedia.net forum just day before yesterday. Now, here we are in this existence, and if we define it, well, let's do it another way. If we define the ultimate, again, that problematic phrase, if we define that happy ending place as a place where there are no problems, there is no conflict, there is no struggle, we tend to see this world differently. Now, if we defined perfection as that, we would then be more inclined to do things to reproduce that here by getting rid of problems and burning up stuff with mystic yoga and interfering with the situations that are developing for our own benefit. In other words, to reach into that potential reservoir of the capacity to have peace and compatibility in all things, and bring that here from our essence to create peace and compatibility in all ways now. Why do we think that? Well, we think that because we don't like all the struggle we have to go through here. Therefore, there must be freed from the struggle. Well, let's examine that for a second. I know we don't like the pain of struggle or whatever here. I know that. That's obvious. Now, I'm not going to get into a whole huge analysis of difficulties in the spiritual world because it's too long. Let's just consider, what if, this is a what if consideration. What if all of this that we consider to be so difficult to deal with is absolutely essential, is absolutely necessary for us to display ourselves in all our glory? For example, using the Pandavas, Kauravas, if some yogi did neutralize everything and everything was fine, of course Krishna could have done that too, there would have been no Bhagavad Gita, there would have been no Mahabharata, there would have been no glory of Pandavas, you would have never heard of them. So somebody may say, yeah, maybe, but all these people wouldn't have had to suffer so much and they would have been happy then. Now, Krishna could have done that, but didn't. Why? Okay, there are so many reasons to destroy all these people, blah, 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 to right the wrong, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we know that. But the effect of it was minimal after a few hundred years, as compared to the destruction which had to take place. Or put another way, maybe, what if all of these people just needed to go through this? It's just absolutely essential for them to evolve. Okay, we can say that there were too many armies, too much military and so on, but that's also been there throughout history. That's just something that's always going to be a problem. It wasn't that there was open warfare all the time. There's been far more warfare in this century and far more military arrangements now than ever before in history. Let's just put all of that aside, just for the sake of argument, and only talk about the fact that problems, generically speaking, problems are stimuli. They are impetus. There are no problems. There are only opportunities. In our present state of existence, if there were no problems, everything was fine, we didn't have to work, we didn't have to struggle, we didn't have to resolve, we'd probably just lay around all day, you know, completely becoming like a sloth, just without any endeavor. But that's not what happens, because the soul, the essence, the spirit wants to evolve, wants to progress, wants to connect, wants to expand connections and integration. So for the soul to just stay at rest all the time is very difficult. So therefore, to fulfill its need for this, it creates agitation. Just even an agitation that says, no, not just this, something else is enough. And because everybody has the same feeling, things are always moving. Energy is always moving. It's always shifting. It's always changing in relationships. And this state of not being satisfied in inertia, it causes everything to always be moving. And as soon as it starts moving, there's conflict. And this creates all that we have. It seems to be a necessary part of our existence. Therefore, there was no yogi to burn it all up at the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Therefore, we can't do it now either. And therefore, those who attempt to manipulate others for their own advantage, to make things better for them, always get caught by that. Because that's not the way it works. Because the fundamental principle that makes this movement, this motion in this framework and fabric of existence is not going to allow one person to manipulate others for their own benefit. Okay, but shouldn't one do something to improve life? Shouldn't we do things to make life better? Definitely yes, but how? Well, that's why we build houses to keep the weather out. That's why we grow food better and better, more and more optimally. We make money optimally. We learn how to take care of our health optimally. We do everything better and better by knowledge, by experience. And we will also do that in relationship with others, with our own spirituality, our own connectivity, our own integration. That's also part of the nature of how to do things better, through knowledge and experience. So, does this resolve our difficulties? No, but at least it gives us an understanding of them and thus gives us the strength to continue to work, to try, to strive. I think that might have explained it. There are so many questions, you know, to answer these questions, they're going to be like little lectures in and of themselves. And it's real hard for me to say very little because I always want to make it clear. It's like I just can't give a short answer. I've got this problem. But I'm going to try now so that we don't have to stay here all day listening to me, blah, blah. Here's a question. Do you have to be on Goloka Vrindavan to be in touch with Radha and Krishna? Can't you have that connection right here? After all, do you think there is a real difference between spiritual and material world? Well, that last part, that enters into a whole nother discussion as to how the spiritual and material are all one, and we are just working our way through it to understand it. We create this difficulty to inspire us to have better connection. Do you have to be in Goloka to have the connection to Radha Shyam? No, you can have it right here, of course. But there's connection and then there's interaction. Real interaction is feeling the exchange of the energy, feeling the exchange of the communication, feeling the reciprocation, the personal reciprocation, the intensity of that reciprocation. That is very important. You also want to feel it. You want to grasp it. You want your senses to respond to it according to the sensual inspiration and excitement. You want to be in the middle of it. You want to be interacting with it. You want to be touching it. You want to be feeling it very intensely. Therefore, from that point of view, you want to be right there, touching Radha and Krishna, experiencing their energy, experiencing others who are experiencing their energy in a way which is exciting, inspirational, energetically solid. Now this is something that will come. Yes, it is wonderful, it is magnificent, it is real, but it's not so easy to do. It's an existence work, you know, your whole existence. It's the work of your whole existence to get that state. Here's a hypothetical question. I think this is an interesting question to talk about, although I'm not exactly sure if it makes any if it relates to the way I think, but this is asked, so I'll deal with it. This person is asking me, would I be disappointed if I knew that I never originated from some spiritual realm and that I was never going to Goloka Vrindavan? Would my relationship with Radha and Krishna be any less complete? Wow, that's really a cosmic question when you think about it. It's like, let's put it in another way, much more drastically. Here, I'll be the devil's advocate. You assume there's a God. You assume that God is Radha and Krishna. You assume you came from that God. And you assume you're going to that God. I know that's true because you say you have no remembrance of the past and you have no experience right now of that future. So I am safe to say you are assuming it. You simply believe it was like this and you believe it will be like this. You believe in happy endings. Considering this, is it or is it not so that your present understanding is simply something you feel you would like to believe? It's something you feel is convenient to believe. It gives you pleasure to believe. It is not necessarily better than me who think something totally differently, or anyone else. I choose to believe that, you choose to believe this. I love this question. Why? Because it is exactly the point. Back to the magician and pulling the rabbit. Does anybody really think, before they buy the ticket and spend their money, that when they go to the magic show, they're really going to see a magician pulling rabbits out of hats? Rabbits that were not there before. Does anybody really think that? No. Of course, the children think like that. But the adults don't. But the adults love it just as much. When you pay your money to go to a movie, do you really believe this is the reality? Why do you spend your money to do it when you know it's not real? Because you like it. It's an experience you enjoy. It makes you feel good. If you are aware it's illusion when it's happening, you're not going to feel good about it. You need to believe it to have fun with it. Is there something wrong with that? Difficult situation, isn't it? When you think about it. Does a spiritualist care, ultimately, whether or not really it's true? Therefore, different people in different religions around the world, all of them say, if you challenge them like this, no, it is true. I have faith. I have seen. I believe. And even if they didn't have experience, they say, I believe it so. I have great faith in it. So who am I to say, well, that's wrong? Because another person can turn around and say, well, what you believe is the same exact thing. Because you can't be sure of it until you've got it. Wow, is that mind-boggling. One can hear this discussion and walk out of the room with his head spinning and say, oh my God, there is no ultimate reality. There could be nothing. I just could be creating it all. It's all an illusion. Oh my God. Just see how important belief is, faith is, intention is, desire is. Because without it, you've got nothing. You've got no reason to exist. You've got no reason to do anything. You've got nothing. And who feels good with nothing? But we want to feel good. We feel comfortable when we feel good. When we have love, when we have these wonderful things, it feels right to us. When we feel this connection with Radha and Krishna, it feels right to us, righter than anything else in existence. So my answer to the devil's advocate is very simple. You are absolutely right. And I have chosen to believe this because it feels right to me. And that's all I care about. Whether it's absolutely true or not, or it's absolutely the best, or it's proven philosophically, or it's historical, or it's traditional, I couldn't care less. In other words, my belief and my feeling is free from a need that it existed in the past. Catch this point. This is really a good one. People argue left and right about the origin of the soul, where we came from. It's like earth-shatteringly important in their lives. I remember Prabhupada used to say, I couldn't care less. But sometimes he used to throw out this or throw out that. You know, philosophically, you speak about something now and then, no big deal. I always thought, yeah, cool, who cares, really? But people who needed to agitate, right? You've got to move that energy. You've got to agitate to evolve. They need that. Why? They got to grab that question and strangle it to a conclusion. Me, I don't care. Why? I'll tell you why. Is it really important to me right now for my future evolution, which is all that's important to me, what I did yesterday? Okay, maybe I made some mistake yesterday, but, you know, I can move on now. How about 10 yesterdays ago? Any difference? Eh. 100 yesterdays, 1,000 yesterdays, 1,000,000 yesterdays. How about last lifetime? 10 lifetimes back, 100 lifetimes back. How important is it to you what you did 1,000 lifetimes ago to your present situation now and your progress, your evolution? I don't know. To me, it's as meaningless as it can be. Just keep going back, 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 back as far as you want to go. It doesn't become more meaningful when I get to the first. Because remember, to me, all I care about is how I feel right now, how I feel connected, and how I feel happy and loving and in love and moving forward. It's a real good point if I want to use, for example, that, oh, I came from here, or I came from there, for this reason or that reason. Therefore, you're wrong, I'm right. This philosophy is useless. This one is good. This method good. This one bad. It's all a bunch of the mind. That's just how I see it. Maybe it's really important. Maybe it's an earth-shatteringly important point. Maybe people who are into this stuff are really correct trying to figure it out. But me personally, I don't care. And I really don't care. It's not that I'm just saying that to avoid having to address the issue. I really don't care. And, okay, I would really like to be together with Radha and Krishna. I would really like to be in a wonderful atmosphere. I would like that. That's my long-term goal. But I like that now, too. That's my short-term goal. So I like it now, and it feels good now. And I feel excited about it now. And if there wasn't a then later on, it would not affect my now. Now, the question was, if I knew there was no then, there was no happy ending. Now, just think about that question. If I knew, think about that. Now, how the hell would I know that? How would I know that? The only way I would know that is if I was God. Now, if then someone would say, no, but if God came and told you, but if God came and told me, then where is God coming from? You think God lives in a trailer camp? Just think, God lives in a trailer camp. So he comes on over and he says, hey, Hari, hey, man, you're so wrong. You know, there is no there. Damn it. Jeez, my whole life a waste. I mean, God in a trailer camp. If God is a God, if somebody were to tell me, if anybody were to tell me, that would be the absolute. If I wasn't God and I didn't know it, so somebody, God, had to come and tell me, you think God would live in a trailer camp or God would live in some really nifty place? And if God was everywhere, because therefore he wouldn't live in any nifty place, because he was just everywhere, well then how did he talk to me? Okay, let's say I just merge with the everywhere, but then I would be there. And my feeling now of good, of what is right, what I feel comfortable would be to be in that state. In other words, what really is reflected by me, as me. And when I feel connected, when I feel the connection, when I feel the love, when I feel the reciprocation, when I feel the energy, when I feel excitement, it's because it is there. Again, all that counts, all that is, all that exists is right now and how I am dealing with right now. And the only thing that keeps this understanding from being the most selfish, egocentric, inconsiderate philosophy in the whole universe is that also I like to be of service. So you want the philosophy of Hari in two sentences? Well, you don't have to answer that because you're going to get it anyway. All that there is right now in the present. All that matters is how I feel now. And all I really love to do is to be of service and connect to all there is. And defining all there is a detail. We've already talked about that. You wanted a nutshell, you got it. There it is. And in this context is another question, which I thought formally would be a very difficult question, but I've already prepared the ground for it. How does one have a spiritual connection and communication with spiritual beings who are also here in this plane with me? How do I connect with you? How do I communicate with you? How do I connect and communicate with Radha Shyam, my deities? How do I connect and communicate with Gornatai in St. Petersburg? How do I connect and communicate with demigods? How do I connect and communicate with beings who are around, angels, anyone who wishes to be of service? I am a person. I have consciousness, I have awareness, and I have my energy. You, whoever you are, wherever you are, how powerful you are or how not powerful you are someone else. I, as me, feel your energy and listen to your communication, observe your actions, accept what you send towards me, and reciprocate. End of answer, period. There's no more need for any other discussion. But the mind says, wait, whoa, 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 too fast, too simple. That's not the way it works. Not true. It's exactly the way it works. It's exactly the answer. Then there's something, come on, you know, I'm going to just, you know, feel God. I'm just going to communicate with God. Give me a break. No, yes, that's exactly what you're going to do. Yes. But when you think you can't, you can't. Simple as that. I don't believe it. It's just some blah, blah from this guy on Saturday who just blah, blahs every Saturday. Just, you know, forget it. Maybe, maybe not. But that's your problem, not mine. I guarantee you, of course, whatever that's worth, it's so. And then they always have to challenge. This is their favorite challenge. Have you done that with God? Communicated? Have you seen? Have you felt? Have you communicated? I've got you there, don't I, you fraud? Of course, they don't wait for the answer. And even if they get an answer, they don't believe it. My answer is always, what a stupid question to ask. And their reply is always the same. It's almost as if you're talking to a robot. They say, aha! See? Avoiding the question, because you can't answer it. And then I say, but listen, no matter what I answer, you've already made up your mind what the answer is. What's the use of asking? It's a lot easier for all of us if you'll just go sit in your temple and be very happily convinced that I'm a fraud. I don't have a problem with that. But when people ask me questions, I tend to give honest answers. And I get annoyed when people don't want to hear an answer. This is called a rhetorical question. It means I'm asking a question. I already know the answer. It's simply a statement in the form of a question. And don't even bother trying to answer because I already know what's true. There's a funny a phrase in English people use a lot nowadays. They just go, whatever. In the more cultured times, they used to go, well, if you say so. In other words, whatever you think, it must be true. Because what you think is your truth. So be happy with your truth. I'm happy with mine. Anyway, that was kind of a fun interlude. But if you really want to have that connection and communication, then make the connection and communication. You will be amazed at what happens. Anyway, anyway, whatever. Oh, it's just so much fun. I think It's not like I like these conflicts, but I just think sometimes they're just so much fun. It gives me something to talk about. It's like these conflicts and these problems and these criticisms are useful. They're good. They make life worth living somehow. Anyway. So, I think I have dealt with most of the question. Let me just check here. You know, I get this question all the time from one very beautiful lady there in Moscow. She asks all the time the same question. I don't know which deity to integrate with. Should it be Radha and Krishna? Should it be Shiva and Parvati? Should it be Buddha? Should it be Christ? Who is my deity? I think this is really a fun question. I mean, who do you love? I mean, do I have to tell you who you love? It's like somebody comes up to you and says, tell me who I love. I don't know who I love. Tell me who I love. And then I'm going to look at them and say, huh? What do you mean, tell you who you love? Well, I don't know. Well, if you don't know, then you don't have somebody you love. So what should you do? You should go find somebody to love. I think I'm going to start singing a Jefferson Airplane song. Don't you need somebody to love? Don't you? Anyway, go ahead. So if you don't know who you love, go and find somebody to love. And when you love them, you'll know. Like, for example, if I go into a Buddhist temple, I see a deity of Buddha, I will be very respectful. I'll love the energy. I'll just absorb all the spirituality, but love the deity of Buddha? No, I don't think so. I can see Jesus Christ on the cross. I can respect that. I can appreciate. I can appreciate all the good things. But love, I don't feel that. Lord Shiva and Goddess Parvati, incredible love. Yes, definitely love. Definitely incredible love. Yet at the same time, we're all moving towards Radha and Krishna. And we're all together just being of service to Radha and Krishna. Just like if I love you, I'm holding all of you, and we're all worshiping Radha and Krishna, or Lord Chaitanya. I integrate with you, I integrate with Lord Shiva, Goddess Parvati, I integrate with Radha Shyam. And we are our deities here. Yes? You are my deity that I worship every Saturday. If I had incense, I'd be waving it now, ringing the bell. But that would be ridiculously corny and everybody would say, this guy's nuts. So instead, I worship you by speaking. And I worship Lord Shiva and Goddess Parvati in great love. I worship Radha Shyam in great love, but in particular ways according to the way in which it makes sense. I don't like scratch my head and say, gee, you know, well, I love all of you and I love Lord Shiva and Goddess Parvati, and I love Lord Nrisimhadeva, and I love Gaurinathai, and I love Radha and Krishna, and I gotta choose one of them. Good God, what am I gonna do? So I'm sorry to say this will be the last broadcast we ever have, and I'll never see any of you again because I'm now gonna go in my temple room, and I'm only going to offer Artik to Radha Shyam from now on, and I'm just very sorry. Because my heart is so small, I can't fit more than Radha and Krishna. I mean, they're big deities, you know, and my heart is very little. Oh, please. I never want to hear this question again. Ever.